Interview with Don Wheaton, November 4th, 2010, in Danbury, Connecticut, by Kenneth Durr.
Well, terrific. Let's start at the beginning a little bit. I mean, you came into a family where securities was the business. You ended up going to Stanford, I guess.
That's right.
Did you know when you went to college that you were going to get back into the business, the family business?
You know, after high school, I did spend a summer in our San Francisco office. And then during Stanford, every summer I came back to New York and spent some time in the New York office. And really, when I went into the military for 4 years, I had in the back of my mind that I was going to end up at Wheaton & Company.
You went into the Air Force, right?
Yes.
What'd you do?
Well, actually, I flew fighter planes, and I had signed up when the Korean War started. Actually, I was in the South Atlantic on a Norwegian freighter. I had gotten tired of Stanford and left for 6 months and went around the world. And so when I went back to finish Stanford, I signed up for the cadet program and then ended up at Yale Law School for about 4 or 5 months while I was waiting for them to call me up, just so I still had a, I think it was a 1D draft deferment, and then went in for 4 years and flew, and ended up in Germany, had a very interesting time. We had a brand new all-weather interceptor aircraft to fly, and the combination of doing that and seeing Europe was a terrific experience.
Did you fly Sabre jets?
I went through the Sabre jet program and then at Nellis in Las Vegas, but they ended the war on us just as we finished up, and so I got transferred to Germany.
Okay. So was it into the family business after that?
Right into the family business in New York. And at that time, I went through the back office and learned how to deliver bonds and how to check certificates, and which was something that I think a lot of people did then, which they don't do now, which was very important. Mm-hmm. And Wheaton was very... very focused on the efficiencies of the back office. In a sense, we had to be, because we were more, you know, we did things at risk as a dealer. We had to be more efficient. Our spreads were narrower, and my father and my brother were both interested in kind of the details of how to be efficient in the back office, which was unusual for Wall Street at that time. Most partners were really focused on the front office. They were salesmen, they were bankers, they were market dealers, I guess, and underwriters.
Why did you have the focus on the back office?
I think it was, one, just an instinctive interest on my father and brother and all of us, that we had to be more efficient as a dealer, and then as a third market maker, which is really dealing, but dealing in a specific area where the primary market was the stock exchange.
Give me the broker dealer differentiation then that you're implicitly making.
Well, a dealer really has an arm's length relationship with his customers. He makes a market based upon his inventory and his interest in a particular security. He is willing to buy or sell into his own inventory and take the risk that decision will result in profitability when you kind of go on out on the other side of the market.
Okay.
Whereas a broker really takes no capital risk. He works for a commission based upon a transaction that he handles. His risk is his overhead that he has. It's quite a fundamental difference. And we were primarily a bond market, a bond dealer, and that was the background of Weeden & Company. We were dealing in California municipal bonds, and then we found that there was a national interest in those. That's why we opened an office in New York in 1927, and also Los Angeles the same year.
And the company started in 1922, right?
Yes, that's right. And
when did you get into industrials, securities?
That's a little vague. The first thing that we did was to begin making markets in utility preferred stocks, primarily those that are focused on California, Southern California Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric. I'm going to have to answer that.
That's fine. No problem.
No, that's taken care of.
Okay.
And at that time, while those securities were listed on the New York, it was, I think they had off-exchange rights so that even members of the New York Stock Exchange could make markets in preferred stocks, simply because there wasn't enough activity to create an auction market. And that was the experience in corporate and municipal and treasury bonds, that all of those, really going back to the teens, had been listed on the New York, and the primary market was there. And then as the institutions became more and more active and more dominant in the buying and selling of corporate and municipal and treasury bonds, they tended to go off the exchange. They became a negotiated market between the market maker and the institution who wanted to either buy or sell his position. And so there was a trend that had already established itself even before the third market became gained its notoriety, so to speak.
Right. But this is a trend in bonds, and it seems like the New York Stock Exchange was really, really went into stocks and sort of let bonds alone to a great degree.
That's right, because the public were more interested in the stocks, and those are the things that had greater volatility. It was the kind of thing that member firms with their brokers found more interesting to their customers, and really set the stage for an appropriate auction market environment. Small transactions, odd lots were quite a large percentage of activity back then. And anyway, it was in the early 30s that we got involved in preferred stocks, again, California-oriented. And that slowly developed. And then in the late 30s, when the, I forget what, the Public Utility Holding Company Act came along, and these holding companies had to get rid of a lot of their operating companies and consolidate geographically, and so that the underlying operating company securities were available and were being acquired by insurance companies and bank trust departments. It was a regulated industry with a predetermined return with a growth element involved, and it looked like an attractive security for insurance companies and banks, which were the dominant, when I say banks, bank trust departments at that time. So we, because our customers were entirely institutional, we followed their interest. And so when they became more interested in preferreds and then utility common stocks, it was a natural thing for us to make markets in those. And so we became, now a lot of those utility stocks were also listed on the New York. Mm-hmm. But they, the characteristic of the New York was to hand out these securities sort of to different specialists, so that a specialist didn't end up concentrating on utility common stocks. He had industrial of various sorts and maybe one or two utilities. And so the understanding of the utility market and what was going on from a regulatory standpoint, the trends and so forth, were not well known. Also, that specialist didn't have a relationship because he was precluded from having institutional customers. They all had to go through a member broker. So because they were not the kind of securities, or let's say the activity was not small odd lots and round lots, it was more larger size, and they were infrequent, it didn't suit his ability to improve and facilitate a continuous auction market process.
Right.
And so it they tended to go off the exchange. Now, they didn't go into the area of securities that the members could make markets in. They just were understood by the exchange, because the specialists had little interest in them, that it was okay for people like Blythe and Company and First Boston, neither of which either wanted to be a member of the exchange or couldn't because of their structural characteristics. And they, in fact, cooperated with these investment bankers who were in the business of taking positions and making markets in lots of bonds, and doing it in utilities was also a natural development.
So when you came in 56 or so, how much of your company's business was still in that area of bonds or municipal-related securities?
Oh, most of it was in that area. And we did have, you know, I think that in the early 50s, we probably made markets in anywhere from maybe 60 to 90 different utility common stocks.
Okay.
And at that time, did business with some New York Stock Exchange brokers who felt that perfectly comfortable in coming to us. And the specialist was perfectly comfortable in having them come if, for instance, Kansas City Power and Light wouldn't trade for a couple of days and Lazard Frères had 1,800 to sell. The specialist really had no interest in taking on those 1,800 shares. That was not his role.
Right.
And he understood that, and to have somebody else do it was just fine with him.
When, or more importantly, why did you start moving into industrials then, the kinds of things that specialists might have been interested in trading?
Again, it was our customers who encouraged us to do that. I use the example in my book of Old Colony Trust, which was the trust department of First National Bank of Boston. And they came to us and said, you know, we do business in these utility stocks. Why don't you you know, we have trust accounts where we're buying and selling small amounts of Standard Oil of New Jersey, not because we think that Standard Oil of New Jersey is now a good buy or a good sell. It's just that money has come into that trust, or it there is a demand for it, and we have to buy or sell anywhere from 100 to 1,000 shares, and we don't need a broker. We don't need his advice. We don't need any research in order to make the decision of what we want to do.
And to pay that commission.
And to pay that commission, because essentially the markets that we made, you know, on average, saved them about half the commission. It varied. Sometimes if we were an aggressive seller, we would save them the full commission. Sometimes we would not save them much at all, but we would provide the 500 or 1,000 shares at that price that they could not get on the floor of the exchange at that time.
When did you start to see a little concern or pushback from the New York Stock Exchange?
You know, it was in the late 40s when Blythe & Company, who also was basically a banker, investment banker, and did a lot of market making in utility stock, decided to do the same thing. Blythe was a little bit different than us because they quite often relied upon the New York Stock Exchange member firm brokerage community to distribute large blocks of stock, utility stocks, that they were exposed to from one of their customers. And the sort of thing that Whedon didn't see. And so they would set up a secondary distribution at the end of the day, and they would put a two commission on that sale, or 2.5 commissions, and made it very attractive for brokers to go out and market that particular security. And that was the way that Blythe would take care of this large block that they were committing to from some insurance company or whomever they were dealing with. And so when they started making markets like we did, and you might say this is, what do they call it, where you're saying something that you really don't know, that it's
right.
hearsay evidence.
Yeah.
But we knew that they had been approached by the New York and said, hey, we don't mind you doing it in utilities, but our member firm, the fellows on the floor, are not happy with you getting involved in industrial common stocks, which are our bread and butter. And so they stopped doing it. It might have been that they just lost money doing it. I don't know, but I'm
but that
pretty sure that I have it right.
Yeah. How about your company? What was your
Well, we had no relationship with the stock exchange member firms except the occasional one that I talked to you about. We had a very strong relationship with non-member broker dealers all over the country. There were about 4,000 of them at that time. Their customers, let's say after the war, were also interested in equities, in growth. There was a positive feeling that equities were the thing to buy as opposed to bonds. And so they... And their customers came to them and said, hey, we would like to buy Standard Oil of New Jersey. Well, the non-member broker dealer said, unfortunately, I don't make anything on that because for me to get 100 shares off of the exchange, I have to go through a member who has to charge me the full commission. And so when we were willing to sell him 100 shares at the opening plus a quarter of a point, and he could turn around and sell it at the opening plus the full commission, he could make maybe 40% of the normal commission, which was much better than his going to, say, Merrill Lynch and saying, Merrill Lynch, could you do something for me someplace else at some time in the future? And so we did a lot of business, and we didn't mind doing the odd lots and the round lots. And, of course, odd lots, at that time, if we're over $20 a share, there was an odd lot differential of a quarter of a point. So if we did something a quarter of a point over the last sale, the non-member broker-dealer could turn around and charge the full commission. And he was delighted. And in fact, many of them said, you know, if it had not been for Whedon and A.W. Bankert and New York Hanseatic and a couple of others who provided this over-the-counter market, we might have gone out of business. And so that was part of our business. The other part was the part of making markets for the institutions who felt that they had no obligation to any member in terms of buying or selling that particular block of stock. And when we talk about a block would be 1,000 shares. A good example of that was the Minnesota Pension Fund back in that period of time, where they were buying lots of 500, 1,000, 2,000 shares of a range of utility stocks. And they utilized the third market at that time. That was before anybody called it the third market. Because they could come in after the close to four of us, American Securities, Blythe, First Boston, Whedon and Company, and say, I'm looking for 1,000 shares each of these six utility stocks. Give me your best offering. And many times they would get it net at the closing price. So that was much better than giving that order to Merrill Lynch or Payne Webber or somebody who had an office in Minnesota or Minneapolis, and who kind of felt that the state ought to use local brokers in order to, brokers with local offices, rather than going to New York and doing that business.
So, you've given me a good sense of how your business was evolving here, and you talked about you really worked in the back office a good bit in your early years in Whedon.
I knew the back office, yes.
How much did you get out and sort of interface with the rest of the industry, with your customers, with regulators, that sort of thing?
Well, with customers, I had been a market maker in dollar bond, municipal bonds. Most municipal bonds traded on a basis point manner, and there were certain bond issues that were so large that instead of doing it at a, you know, 5.20 less a point and a half, we would just make a market 99 to a half in dollars, and we would be willing to buy on our bid and sell on our offering. And I did that for a couple of years, maybe 3 years, and then I went over to the stock trading desk and began to go out and call on customers. Usually it was the smaller customers that we didn't do business with, and my lack of knowledge of selling wouldn't hurt us too much. I had some experience, certainly in market making in bonds, and I had some experience in selling to the institutions and to the non-member broker dealers.
Now, you folks would have been members of the NASD, is that right?
We were always a member of the NASD. In fact, my father helped to find Wally Fulton, who at that time was the Securities Commissioner back in 1939 of California. And he became the first president and served that way for a long period of time. The question was, how did we...
Interested in your relationships with regulators, including the NASD and maybe even the SEC.
Well, we certainly had a relationship with the NASD, but we were institutional. We were dealt with other people in the firm, non-member and member firms. We had no retail business. So the focus of that self-regulatory body on what was your relationship and how did you handle your interaction with your customer was really not a problem with us or with them.
They were mostly focusing on people dealing with the public?
Yes, they were establishing, the NASD was set up to self-regulate the non-member broker-dealers who were out marketing securities, either ones that they had in their own position or ones that they were brokeraging, and they wanted to make sure that they didn't do it in a inappropriate or fraudulent manner. But we didn't have that problem because we had no customers. Nobody put their money with us. Mm-hmm. Nobody was exposed to our capital requirements. All of our business was delivery against payment, so the relationship ceased 7 days after, and they either got paid or we got paid from them very quickly. And because our focus was on municipal bonds for such a long time, there again, we had no relationship with the SEC because they were not involved in that business. So from that standpoint and the standpoint that we were not a member of an exchange, from the standpoint that we had no retail business or relationships that had to be overseen or regulated, we really didn't know much about the SEC up until the time that we became aware of some a decision that the New York Stock Exchange did with respect to a municipal securities down in Dallas, where they in one day pulled their ticker tape and required all of their members to withdraw their direct lines.
That's the silver case.
That was the silver case. And up until that time, we really had no involvement or reason to wonder what the SEC was doing or what their thinking was, how they viewed competition, etc.
Well, tell me about the silver case and how that how that changed the way you folks looked at your business.
Well, the silver case was something that Silver went to court in the District Court of New York against the New York Stock Exchange for having it was a conspiracy among its members to reduce the competition on the basis that somehow they had done something wrong, which the New York Stock Exchange was not willing to tell them the basis for having done this. So they felt that there was an antitrust violation, and they went to court. And in fact, that was in 59, and finally in the early part of 62, I think his name was Frederick Van Pelt Bryan, who decided on behalf of Silver, basically that there was a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Mm-hmm. And that was very pleasing to us, which seemed to be a natural outcome of that. then very quickly after that, the appeals court reversed that 2-1. And the reversal was basically based upon a, what do you call it, an amicus curiae submitted by the Securities and Exchange Commission that said essentially, you know, we there is a requirement under the Securities Act to encourage self-regulation, and we feel that the New York should have the right extending to what to the kind of action that they took in order to maintain their ability to regulate their members. And so it was on that concept that the appeals court reversed themselves.
Now, you must have been concerned that if they could do that to silver, they could do that to you.
Well, yes. And so that was of great concern to us. We had been surprised that the SEC took that position. Up until that time, we had kind of watched the whole process. And then, fortunately, it did not rest there. But the lawyers for Silver, Silver was dead now, but his wife was a lawyer. They decided to go forward and take it to the Supreme Court. At which time we said we should go down and talk to the SEC and we should talk to the Justice Department. And our efforts with the SEC were really inadequate. We didn't find interest particularly in what we were doing.
What'd you tell them?
And we said, who do we talk to about this particular case? And it was more or less the kind of thing that the SEC said, we don't talk about things that we're involved in. And so I think that we that was when we ran into Dave Silver, who we had found out had been a clerk for Van Pelt Bryan and was now working for the SEC. And actually, we met with him, if I remember correctly, at White's Restaurant and explained to him the competitive elements of underlying this decision, what kind of ramifications it might mean. And I think that Dave later on had indicated that he was responsive, although he was a kind of a low man on the totem pole, and had explained his position, but found that the SEC felt that their position on the importance of supporting self-regulation was the predominant issue from their point of view. Meanwhile, we went to the Justice Department, and there were, oh, who was there? Kestenbaum, George Raycraft, others who, and eventually Don Baker, who really jumped on this. I mean, they, it was, this was a classic, you know, problem. It was similar to, I guess, the Associated Press, where the Associated Press told its membership that they couldn't do things, they couldn't relate to anybody else outside of the membership, and the Supreme Court said that they can't do that. They have to allow their members to do whatever they wanted.
Real simple antitrust.
Very basic, yeah. I mean, if antitrust means anything, this was a classic case for it. And basically, the Supreme Court came down on the side of Silver, saying that yes, while the Exchange Acts did turn over responsibility for oversight of the industry, and therefore was superior to the Sherman Antitrust Acts. It didn't go all the way. It wasn't a carte blanche that the Sherman Antitrust could not come into our industry and apply in certain conditions. And really, what they said was, you know, there's a basic due process. That is, the New York Stock Exchange had to go through a due process, and then the SEC had to go through a due process of a certain action being taken by the New York Stock Exchange, and had the right to reverse New York did if they felt that it involved an anti-competitive action.
Right.
So that was kind of the first indication on our part that, you know, the SEC's interest was directed towards, let's say, supporting what the New York Stock Exchange was doing. I think simply because they felt that they were the best self-regulator in the industry, and they didn't want to do anything that would undermine that.
At the same time, the SEC, which had been, you know, sort of going along on autopilot for quite some time, started to actually, you know, take some steps. The special study was shortly after that, I think, and Dave Silver, who you knew, was involved in the special study. Tell me a little bit about your involvement with that. My understanding is that that's where the term came from, the third market.
Yeah. I guess I would just go back and say that it was a surprise to us, this attitude towards competition or a fair field of play, because back in 1940, they did recognize the anti-competitive nature of an effort on the part of the New York to prevent their members from making markets on the various regional exchanges in the 1940 multiple trading case. So what happened in the interim, it was hard to say. But in terms of at the same time that the Silver case was unfolding, there had been a reaction to really egregious insider trading on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. I mean, it came out as the Ray case, but it was the misuse of that marketplace went far beyond that. But that was the focus, and it drew the attention of the SEC, but it also drew the attention of Congress. And it was out of that that Congress reacted to a request by Bill Carey, I believe, who was then chairman, appointed by Kennedy, to really go back and take a look at all of the markets as they had developed from the early 30s, when the Exchange Act
right.
were... and so that was the nature of the special study. Interesting that it was set up in a way that Congress didn't allow the SEC commissioners to determine what that study was going to say. Yes, it reported to the commissioners, but it didn't in turn be, refreshed or whatever, changed by the commissions. I mean, whatever that meant at the time, I don't know. Maybe there was some concern that the commission itself had certain biases that we wanted to take out of the special study, and that's, of course, what happened. The special study started out by, as I understand it, Milton Cohen said, okay, we're going to divide all of this study into the Project 1, which is this, the exchanges, Project 2 is the over-the-counter, and Dave Silver, meanwhile, had introduced, hey, there's this other market, which is the over-the-counter market, but in listed securities. So that was Project 3, and that became the third market, and which was a nice thing because it was easier to say than the over-the-counter market for listed securities.
So did you talk to him and explain to him how this business works?
Well,
you talk to other folks as well?
Out of their developing a whole study of the third market, they asked us, and at that time, we were the only firm that really sensed the issues involved here. I mean, people like First Boston and Blythe kind of were indifferent. This was a small part of their business. And they were mostly institutional-oriented anyway. Then there were five or six fellows who were only making markets in very small amounts for the non-member broker-dealers, and we kind of covered the waterfront in terms of who we dealt with. And so, we were anxious to tell the SEC what was happening because we didn't feel that there was any wrongdoing despite what the New York was suggesting, that we were a competitive market and the people that we dealt with only dealt with us because it was to their advantage or their fiduciary, their beneficiary's advantage to deal with us. Basically, because it was a fungible product, we were giving them a better price or a larger amount at the same price, whatever benefit that they saw, that was what we provided. But because we had no relationship with these people, it was an arm's length negotiated deal on each transaction that was the basis for our relationship. And so we wanted the SEC to know that. And we were very happy to expose to them all of our information as to what the last sale was at the time that we traded, what kind of markets we made, what profits we had, who we dealt with, why they came to us in the first place.
Did you get any skepticism from the folks doing the special study who had been listening to the exchange?
No, I thought that our relationship was very, very straightforward, and it went from those who were involved in sort of designing the questionnaires to our customers and to our competitors, the other third market makers. What was I going to say? I lost my trend there. What was your question again?
You were just talking a little bit about how the commission, how the special study group worked with you and got information.
So we were willing to help design the questionnaires that we thought would give them as full an understanding of what was going on, and then. A fellow named Walter Werner was assigned the job of really pulling all of that together and making sense out of all of that. And we were still going down there, and we were very happy to help them build a conclusion about the, not conclusion, but a consolidation of all of the information that they had found out, which was being written by Walter Werner. And we were quite comfortable with that. It was very straightforward. It was the most, you know, and in that particular case, we got along very well with the SEC. We thought that they were very bright. They were cooperative. There seemed to be no prejudices, biases, so that was a very good result from our standpoint.
When the report came out, and it sort of exposed a lot of people to this business that a lot of folks hadn't thought about. Did you see a change? Did you get more customers? Did you get more competitors?
No, I don't really remember there. It was certainly allowed us to stand up a little taller and speak about what we were doing. Up until that time, we felt that staying under the radar, doing our business, there were the non-member broker-dealer community was just delighted with us. The institutions were varied, actually, because to many of them, the idea that we introduced to them, which was there was another price available besides the last sale plus a minimum commission, complicated the process that they went through to give out their orders for execution. Up until that time, anything in listed stocks, really you could give it to anybody who was a broker who went to the same marketplace and would theoretically get the same offering from the specialist or from the book. And so you could give that order to anybody. And so there was a tendency of institutions to say, okay, well then I will try and see if there's one or the other of those brokers who could benefit me in some way. And the banks said, hey, we'll encourage commercial deposits with this business, feeling that we are not jeopardizing our fiduciary responsibility if they thought about it. Mutual funds had their own brokers sold their mutual funds, and this was a way of giving them a little frosting to the on the cake of the upfront charges that they made.
With no price competition, there's always something else going on.
Right, and investment advisors were had their own deal. They would say, "Fine, you turn over that account to us, and we will give you all of the commissions that we develop by buying and selling." So we had problems in convincing the natural customers of ours, the institutions, to do business with us. And there was a whole slew of arguments why they shouldn't. Some of the trust accounts had built in that the business had to be done on a certain exchange. And others, argued that there was always uncertainty, and they might be criticized, and who knows, you don't print your transactions in the open market, and so there's might be some confusion as to whether we're really doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we went through all of that, and of course the New York, as they saw that institutions were becoming a larger portion of the activity, and we were getting more than our share, they became more and more concerned about it. In fact, they formalized the requirement that their members could not go and use our market unless they checked through a governor on the floor of the exchange. And, of course, you know how far that went.
Right.
So it did help us because it gave us an opportunity of really using some of the language in the special study to remind or suggest that there was a price differential, because that's exactly what they had concluded, and therefore suggested that maybe there was a fiduciary responsibility to at least check us. And of course, that ended up with people like Pomerantz going after the banks and some of the mutual funds when they found that there was blatant disregard for the third market that now had grown to a level and had a, let's say, a public image now because of the special study that could not be ignored.
Pomerantz?
Abe Pomerantz. He was one of these, what do you call them? I forget.
State regulator?
No, he was a lawyer who would do the... he would sue on behalf of all of those owners of Fidelity funds.
A class action kind of
thing. A class action,
yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
And or people who were part of a trust of the banker's trust or whatever.
Well, we really are looking at a point here where your business is taking off, mid-60s, you know, shortly after the special study and
right.
Through the 1960s. Was this, and you talked about some of the reasons, although you also talked about this resistance. I guess, was it just the sheer volume of institutionals that overcame this resistance, or what was behind that growth in the 60s?
Well, the growth was in part due to increased recognition. Secondly, the institutions were getting larger, particularly the mutual funds, and were looking for larger and larger offerings or markets, and were really growing faster than the capacity of the specialist system to handle it. And so they first of all began to use us more and more, and then they encouraged the dealer-oriented members of the New York Stock Exchange to respond by becoming block traders. Essentially, they were becoming critical of the inadequacy of the specialist system. They were saying, "Hey, we're losing business to the third market," and so some of them, like Solomon or Goldman Sachs or Bear Stearns, Shields, and others began to say, "Okay, come to us with your block, and we'll put up our own money and become a block positioner, and we will take the risk." And so that was also developing during the 60s.
They would have still been going through.
They still go through the New York Stock Exchange,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But essentially that business was negotiated upstairs and really brought to the floor of the New York. And then, of course, as this became more widespread, known more widespreadly, and the mutual funds were very, very active at that time, and that the mutual funds had many non-members who were actively selling mutual funds, and this idea of giving a little extra frosting to them for doing that, they found that the regional stock exchanges had a capacity to provide that, because there was a give-up opportunity within the framework of the New York Stock Exchange so that a New York member of both of regional exchanges could then, if the transaction took place on one of the regionals, he could give up part of his commission to a regional member only. And then the regional members, the regional stock exchanges, expanded their membership to include really non-members who paid a minimum commission to have non-member access to the regional exchange, which even spread further the ability of the mutual funds to distribute those commissions to those who were doing business in mutual funds. Mm-hmm. And that was of course that was watched, and you know, eventually it was Bob Hack at one point who makes his Economic Club statement that, look, it's gotten so, we've got to do something, and it really is this fixed commission, which is with respect to institutional-sized orders that has so much fat in it for distribution to a wide variety of people that is what's fragmenting the marketplace, and we've just got to get rid of fixed commissions.
Right. Before he did that, there was a little flurry of interest in fixed commissions in about 68 or so. The SEC, the Justice Department, were both having hearings on fixed commissions. Did Whedon weigh in at that point?
Well, yes. There was a hearing in 68 on fixed commissions. Right. And at that time, I think that the Justice Department didn't have their own hearings. They just they made a contribution to those hearings. And
what was Whedon's position?
Well, ours was, first of all, to describe and to defend the competitiveness and the appropriateness and the fact that there was nothing untoward about what we were doing in terms of harming the public interest or misusing our role as a non-reporting marketplace and so forth. And we believe at that time we said, hey, upon questioning, we said that there was no reason to continue fixed commissions, that we didn't need them, and we didn't think that they were appropriate because of the economics involved. I mean, the fact that a 10,000 share order, which was not an unusual one back in 68, 69, would give you 100 times the commission relative to a 100 share transaction, where probably the cost of handling it was twice. So it was kind of absurd to, I mean, it was so absurd that it's surprising that the commission didn't understand that. So one looking at it saying, what are they thinking? And yes, we listened to Keith Funston saying that this is one of the pillars of the stock exchange, and the American system of capitalism, and they were listening to that. I mean, this is, that's what really surprised us about the SEC mentality. And of course, by 1968, you had had the business of Chase listing, because the 64 amendments to the exchange required the same kind of listing and reporting of over-the-counter stocks. And so a lot of, particularly the banks, said, hey, the reason that we're in the over-the-counter market is that we really don't have to do all of the reporting and paperwork and regulation or whatever it might come out of having to list on an exchange. And so now we have to do it anyway, so we might as well take advantage of whatever we feel are the advantages of listing. And that's when Chase in 1965 listed. And M.A. Shapiro quite properly, rightfully, said, hey, this is really a Sherman antitrust violation. Now, see the difference between Shapiro, they were really taking something that was his business and taking it away from him. Whereas we were trying to take their business away from them. I wouldn't say take it away from them. We just wanted to compete with it. Mm-hmm. So we had a little bit of a different view of that whole issue that Shapiro was bringing up. And we declined to go forward with him in his thinking about bringing an action against the SEC and the New York Stock Exchange for violating the Sherman Antitrust Act, even though the Justice Department said that the rules of the New York Stock Exchange, namely 394, were a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. SEC didn't pay any attention to that, except to have a very thorough investigation of Rule 394. That was done by Gene Rotberg. And I think it was, 20,000 pages of, and 2,000 pages of data and 200 pages in the report, which really suggested some ways that you could change that would be acceptable to the third market people and to Shapiro. And they deep-sixed that. This SEC deep-sixed that report for 5 years. Well, what was the basis for doing that?
You've got a very conservative commission at that point, clearly.
Well, yes, that's right. Manny Cohen, who had been around for a long time, and he was, we just didn't understand it. We really, my father reluctantly accepted the compromise 394B, where the sons said it's not going to work, but we will do whatever we can to make it work. And we scrupulously took information on every time we were exposed to an order that came off of the exchange in a block that kind of went through their process. I think there were 125 transactions during that year. In fact, we had a full-page ad showing exactly what we did and what happened on all of those. And after that, there was almost no business that came from New York Stock Exchange brokers to us to put us into competition with the floor. And anyway, that was... So, 1968, the SEC had... punted on their ability to correct that situation, and were, holding hearings on fixed commissions and, ignoring what the Justice Department said in their full brief. When you say conservative, that's an unusual word to use. Other people might say that it was something a lot different than that.
Yeah. Well, you were certainly saying things because it's about that time that you start to get into the headlines a little bit as being someone who's speaking out on behalf of, certainly on behalf of your company, but just generally on behalf of you know, creating a truly centralized market. What was behind that?
Well,
what was,
well, I think that our experience with 394B and what came out of those hearings, I mean, there were, I think there were two people representing the third market in those hearings, and I bet there were 50 people from all over the country who represented every district where there was a congressman who was on, or a senator who was on some subcommittee having to do with the securities industry. And, you know, the weight was certainly against us, and the SEC seemed to be somewhat indifferent to all of this. And so the young Whedon said, look, it, we've got to go public on this. I mean, because it was very clear that the New York Stock Exchange was very much concerned because our volume was going up, and we were really challenging their way of doing business. And that's when they started talking about discounts on $500,000 trades and less. And the idea was we're going to specifically target those kinds of trades where the third market is making the penetration. And so we, you know, I think the seminal letter that we sent the SEC was after those hearings, and I had just come off a race for Congress in 1968, and I was really assigned the job of going public and explaining to whomever we had to explain it to, because we felt that, you know, the New York Stock Exchange was going out to their corporate listers and telling them what a bad market we were. And, I mean, they were saying a lot of very unpleasant things. So we sent a letter to the SEC that essentially pointed out that there were certain changes that were taking place in the market that were quite that were quite natural, one of which was this trend away from auction markets when institutions became larger and larger participants in those securities. Secondly, the other thing was the technology that was coming along. Now, this was 69, and that's, you know, 2 years before NASDAQ came along.
Right.
And we just pointed out that the, you know, the marketplace is no longer centralized. It's not a geographical concept. It's really a communications concept. And the technology will allow people from all over the country to participate in a central market. And that's what people were concerned that there was fragmentation going on in the marketplace, and that was causing unfairness. It was causing a reduction in transparency and full disclosure of what was going on in the market and so forth. And people began to talk about bringing all of the transactions together on one tape, which we, in that letter, we supported it. In fact, we were one of the first who said, hey, if you're worried about these things not being printed, we'll be happy to print them. If you're worried about uneven regulation, we're certainly willing to be regulated. We tried to undermine all of what might be considered legitimate arguments.
So the concern about fragmentation was that what you're talking about, that's geographic, it's different exchanges. And when you start talking about different exchanges, that concerns
and
some folks.
And, yeah, why do trades go out to the Pacific Exchange? You know, why do they go into the third market? Because we don't know what's going on, we have no way of evaluating whether they are best execution or not. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are some reasons that are untoward, are negative, against the public interest, and so we tried to undermine all of those and said, "Hey, this is a natural process. If you are concerned about centrality, there is a solution to it, and that is in the technology."
Were there other people who were thinking those same thoughts at that point? Who were thinking about unifying all these markets with computers?
You know, I don't remember. One of the things was that we were such a good advocate for the third market that all of the third market people were quite happy to have us spend all of our time and effort doing that. I mean, Boy Jeffries, for instance, told me, "Hey, you know, I don't have time for that. Good luck, Don." And others, felt that they had very good relationships with the New York Stock Exchange and the brokerage community, and why should we get into a public argument? And we had essentially nothing to lose, and felt that now, because that business was becoming more significant to us, that we had almost a responsibility to talk out about it.
And your brothers are doing a lot of the management of the company at any case.
Yes, right. I had a brother who was in operations, and the other one was, at that time, had been in municipals and had taken over sort of the overall direction of the company. And that's what we did, and that was really just the beginning of the New York becoming much more aggressive. And their aggressiveness was, first they tried to demean, to point out the inappropriateness of what we were doing, how it undermined the auction market, which was a kind of a centerpiece or citadel of American
right.
capitalism. They were also desirous of getting rid of us through regulation. And that was, of course, the whole purpose of the Martin Report, which called for the elimination of the third market, an extraordinary document that got the proper reaction, which was almost overwhelmingly negative. One of the wonderful things that happened to us was Jim Lurie walking into our office. He was a very well-known economist with the University of Chicago, Graduate School of Business. He said, "What can I do to help?" We said, "Write a letter to the SEC. And he did. And he had 19 signatories out of the 21 top economists in the country. I mean, every name from Milton Friedman on the right to what's his name on the left who did the big I'll think of it in a moment.
Paul Samuelson,
yeah. Right? Mogigliani was there. Steiger. Just 19 names mm-hmm. of, and it was a 1.5-page letter that just demolished the underpinnings of the Martin Report.
Now, my sense of this is that the thing that set the stage for this next phase that you're talking about is sort of the back office crisis and the reevaluation that came after that. Congress is having hearings and they're talking about...
Well, the... Right, the... You know, Congress reacted to the fact that the New York Stock Exchange had to close in order to allow its membership to get their back offices in order. And that because of the failure of many of those companies and the fact that the relationship between the brokerage community and their customers was such that the customers were exposed to losing all their money, which was on deposit with these. And so the industry went to Congress and said, hey, what we need is something similar to what the banks have, which is an industry-wide insurance. So that was, so I think it was Congressman Moss who said, okay, if you want us to set up legislation that will provide for SIPC, the securities industry SIPC protection corporation, we're going to take a look at you people. I mean, how did you get into this problem in the first place? So both the House and the Senate, I think beginning in 1971, instituted special studies on their own, where they hired outside people, people like Dave Ratner and Charlie Curtis, Harvey Rowan, Bill Painter, all very good people who came in and took a look at it, look at the issues. And we were very active in going down there and telling them what went wrong, because it not only included what happened in the back office, but just what's happening in the marketplace overall. And what we said in our 1969 letter, we emphasized that.
You know. Now, were you meeting in sort of separate sessions as well as testifying?
Oh, we would go down there and talk to not only members of the committee, the study committee, which was not members of the House or the Senate. And once they did their basic report that went to these committees, then we went through the process of being part of hearings. So we went through both of those steps. And told it as we saw it. We made recommendations why they could solve the problems that they were concerned with, both back office and marketplace. And we were quite pleased with the way both of those studies came out. We thought that they understood it. They understood it, as opposed to the SEC still fussing around with it. It was, you know, and which I have to say, we just never could quite understand that, why they were so reluctant to do what they ultimately came around to doing.
Well, they're starting to, the SEC at this point, I think, early 70s, is starting to do that gradual, they're taking away fixed commission rates on very large orders, and they're moving down step by step. I guess Brad Cook was doing that when he was...
Well, that started before Brad.
I started with Case.
Right, they had... it's hard to say. There was the Martin Report, and then Casey called for public hearings on market structure right after that. I mean, that was an interesting... we were very concerned. We had just been through Hamer Budge, who followed Manny Cohen. And while we thought that Manny Cohen was close to the New York Stock Exchange for whatever reason, because, I mean, none of those, you know, the nice thing, none of those people were dishonest or they were, you know, doing anything untoward. They just had an attitude. And we didn't fit into that attitude for a long time. But Budge went a little bit far when the NASDAQ was about ready to start up, and both of the exchanges came to Budge and said, you really can't allow for listed stocks to be on that electronic marketplace. And Budge met with the heads of the NASD, and the NASD reversed their position, which they had reiterated a number of times that listed stocks would be on that system. They reversed that. And that was done with the encouragement of the SEC chairman, Hamer Budge.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
So it's a terrible thing.
How would that have changed your business? Would that have given you an advantage? Would that have been helpful if you'd been able to work on NASDAQ?
Well, remember, that NASDAQ was an effort to bring all of the over-the-counter market makers together to centralize them, to provide a centralized marketplace for unlisted securities. And it was a great step forward, the best thing that happened to the over-the-counter market. Strangely enough, these kinds of technological improvements were just the birth of an extraordinary growth in that marketplace. The CBOE was the same thing with respect to options. And one would think that the New York Stock Exchange would have thought the same way. But they had a structure that was dominated by people who had monopolies on the floor of the exchange, and they didn't want to change. It's just that simple.
Right.
And so Hamer Budge says, hey, these people don't want their markets to be exposed on that marketplace because we're afraid that it might take it over. Well, of course, they should have been afraid. But again, this was an active decision on the part of the SEC, which was a little bit different than maybe a reluctance, mm-hmm. Concern about self-regulation being impaired by antitrust action. Do you see the difference there?
Yeah, I do.
And mm-hmm. so, you know, that was very troublesome. We reacted to that very quickly. And again, recognizing that the only way of getting anything done was to compromise, we did get everybody to agree that we'll have a pilot for about 50 New York Stock Exchange listed stocks that would be done on the newly developed NASDAQ system. And we even followed that and noted that the spread of the market on the New York Stock Exchange had narrowed because of that competition. And then sort of that, but that didn't, it didn't blossom. And so.
Why not?
You know, I think one of the reasons is that the pressure of the New York Stock Exchange on all its members was still considerable. And I think that as it was with the Cincinnati market that came a little bit later, you know, there was just, hey, what are you trying to do? Undermine our marketplace? Why are you doing those experiments with something that can do nothing but help destroy our centrality of the New York Stock Exchange? And so it that kind of never went very far.
We've been talking about the technology, and let's get into that a little bit. The big centralized trading systems that are starting to be played around with. And I read that you were involved in the early stages of some of the first ones, Autex and InstantNet. Tell me a little bit about how you got exposed to those things.
Well, Autex was probably the first one that we were exposed to, and they had started up, a guy named Alan Kay, and that was a fairly simple screen distribution of an inquiry to buy or sell that a broker had received from one of his customers, and it was an ability for a brokerage firm to expose to all of those buy-side people who had a screen at the same time, simultaneously, without the interaction of any salesman, that there was a buy interest of medium size in General Electric, and that if that Houston institution, who might not have a direct relationship with that particular broker, might see that, he'd call up that broker and say, "Hey, I see that you have an inquiry, and we would be interested in that, and this is what we have," and it would be an efficient way of attracting the other side of an order to the sell side broker. And we, who already had a vast array of salesmen around the country, who each time we would get an inquiry, we would call all of through those salesmen, we would call all of those same people. This was a very efficient way of doing it. And while it might not be so beneficial to Whedon, it would certainly be beneficial to the Boston brokerage firm who really didn't have an office in Houston. And so he would support it. And so when we heard about it, we went to Alan Kay and said, if you need some money, we'll go in the second round. And we wanted to be part of that. Now, at that time, because that looked like a very attractive thing, the New York created their own competitive system called BAS. I forget what BAS stood for, B-A-S. And that encouraged all of the member firms to use BAS as an electronic system for distribution of information, and was supported by those people, although they also used Autex. Well, the problem with BAS was BAS actually had distributed information, but that information coming back had to go through the specialist. And the specialist was no better able to handle that thing than he had been in the first place. So it died. It slowly died, and Autex developed. The difference between the two is BAS would not allow us to be part of it, and Autex would. And so, in the back of our mind, we'll put some money in there, and it'll be very difficult for Autex to ever agree on the banks of the Potomac not to allow any third market people to use it. Right. Okay? So that was in 1968. 1969, InstantNet came along, and that was a little bit different in that there they had a system that would allow institutions to interact with one another. And that was what their concept was. So InstantNet supposedly was eliminating not only the third market, but all of the member brokers, okay? And at that time, the institutions were not ready for that. Their ties with the financial community were such that they didn't want to bypass them for whatever reason. And many of them took InstantNet because Abe Pomerantz was going around saying, "Hey, are you guys using the third market? Are you using these new electronic systems that allow you to bypass and get a better price and so forth?" And so a lot of them, as a matter of protection, did take these, but they weren't used very much. Because basically, the institution was saying, look it, I am the one who is sitting back listening to what's in the marketplace. I don't go out and tell people what I want to do. I want to react to what I hear from the sell side. So none of the institutions put anything in there. So it, for a long time, until the mid-80s, really, when Bill Lupien used it to facilitate business in the over-the-counter market, and really to incorporate market makers in the over-the-counter market to use InstaNet as a place where they could get a better bid or offering than they could by going to one of their competitors.
Right.
No. And so they would secretly put things into InstaNet, and the institutions would see the market is a quarter, three quarters in the NASDAQ system, but I see that there's 500 shares at a half, and I'll take that. And so as that happened more and more, it created a critical mass. Mm-hmm. And so whereas the over-the-counter market makers really didn't like InstaNet, they used it because it served their purpose of not having to go to their customer, their competitor, but could go to some unseen institution to help them balance their inventories. And the institutions then used it more and more, and it became a very viable inside marketplace because the over-the-counter market was maybe not conspiring to keep markets wider. They instinctively did that, okay? It was just understood that that was better for everybody to have a quarter, three-quarter market as opposed to a quarter-half market,
right,
publicly displayed.
Now, but you had, we didn't put a lot of money into InstaNet at some point.
Yes,
right?
We did over time. And when we got to the point where we had our own problems in 1977, we owned about 92% of InstaNet. Okay. Because we thought it was a great idea. It frankly competed with our own salespeople and got no cooperation from them. We kept feeding it.
So you looked at this as an investment, I guess.
Well, it was an investment. It was a recognition that technology was going to take us in that direction. Okay?
Yep.
That's the nature of technology. It eliminates middlemen. It automates a manual operation. I mean, the telephone company. When I grew up in Alameda, we had one of the largest buildings in Alameda, California, was owned by the telephone company, and it was lined with women who were saying, "Number, please."
Right.
And slowly but surely, those middlemen disappeared.
Right. Well, let's talk about the one that
maybe if they had owned the telephone company might not have wanted to go that route.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Cincinnati Exchange and your relationship with them.
Well, that came about in 1969. And in 69, we were in the process of joining various regional exchanges because we found that they were a good place for us to either make a market or to provide a bid or an offering to an order that was coming in from one of these mutual funds who had given it to a member firm who went out to one of the exchanges in order to get a give up to other people that they were interested in compensating. And so we were joining the Detroit, the Pacific, the Philadelphia was aggressive on that. In fact, they went to the point around that time of encouraging institutional membership, one of which was the state of Connecticut, who was aggressive about, because they felt that if they couldn't join the exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, they could join the Pacific, the Philadelphia, and they could benefit from the give up down there. And so here was the Cincinnati that was only doing 1,500 or 1,700 shares a day, mostly odd lots in Cincinnati, telegraph and telephone, or telephone and telegraph. And
it must have been just hanging on by a thread at that point.
Yeah, and I think they had maybe 40 or 50 stocks that were listed. Yes, they were dying on the vine. They had a great big building, and nothing was going on. We said, we'll be the, how about if we're the odd lot specialist? So they went through the process of changing their rules to allow us to be the odd lot specialist. And we ran into a little problem because the American Stock Exchange objected to that, feeling that such a change in the rules required a public hearing. Again, delaying tactics. The SEC, to their credit, said no, we'll let this go through. And I think it was in 1970 or whenever, 71, that we started doing that. And, you know, we ballooned the Cincinnati from 1,700 shares to 8 million, I think, when we were finally went, had our own problems and merged with Moseley Hall Garden. So,
but tell me about the automated system that you put in there and so, where that started.
Well, if you remember, you had these two studies by the Senate House, then you had the hearings on it, and then in 1973 they had proposed some legislation, and it was about that time that the New York Stock Exchange was really becoming concerned, and they had kind of shifted their focus from regulating us out of business to really where they wanted to legislate us out of business. And so they, I guess about that time, they had a fail-safe amendment, I forget what it was, 3018 or something like that, that was required hearings, and but that was the first time we were now under the end of 73. We had gone through Hamer Budge, Casey, who, to his credit, recognized after the hearings they had shortly after the Martin Report on market structure. They made the decision that there was no way that they could get rid of the third market. And in fact, there was an interesting dinner. There was, a yearly market structure committee that had been created at the same time, and it was going nowhere, and it was a committee they finally put me on, and because they really couldn't make any decisions as a security of industry without the third market participating and agreeing. And we had a dinner at the end of that, and Casey turned to me after cigars and cognac and so forth and said, well, what about it, Whedon? What are you going to do? And I said, I'm sorry, but getting rid of the third market, it's not right, and it's not in the public interest. And it was shortly after that that the white paper was written and really said, okay, we want to know something more about them, and we want to have some, you know, the SEC should control something. Things that we feel should be controlled in order to properly regulate what's going on, but we accept the fact that the third market is here to stay. So About that time, we have these two congressional committees coming forward and suggesting Exchange Act amendments and getting agreement on that. And then there was the fail-safe amendment that came from the New York Stock Exchange that essentially, because it was clear that all of that was going to get rid of fixed commissions, and that that was going to take place definitely at some point in time. The New York Stock Exchange was afraid that that was going to just eliminate the New York, that everybody was going to scatter and get out of the being members and go off and do their own thing in the over-the-counter market. Despite testimony, I think it was in the Thill case, where Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs and others said, no, we're not going to, even though we get rid of fixed commissions. But anyway, they wanted the SEC to have the power to close us down in case anything looked like something untoward might happen, whatever that means. And at that point, we were through Garrett and Brad Cook. They both really left in 73, and Ray Garrett came along. And in the hearings on that fail-safe amendment, the Treasury Department, the Justice Department, and the SEC all came down and said, okay, you can have something, but we're going to water it down so that, you know, the SEC isn't there poised, ready to get rid of the third market. And that's... So that caused us to say, okay, there's going to be some sort of central market or national market system was the concept that they were talking about.
Right.
And that concept, everybody had agreed. It's going to, first of all, there won't be any fixed commissions. That's out. But in terms of the market structure, we want to put all of the trades on one tape. And we want to put all of the quotations available there in one place so people can take a look at that. And then we want to allow for all of the marketplaces to interact in an efficient way. And for the purpose of allowing something akin to what was developing in the NASDAQ market. Now, the NASDAQ market wasn't perfect from a technology standpoint, but nevertheless, it had this concept of we could put all market makers on the same screen and show there, and then people can make a choice of where they want to go. And so so we said, hey, we didn't think that the NASDAQ system was very efficient. We thought the electronics technology could design a better one. And so my brother Jack, in 1974, began designing one, and we spent a couple of $1 million designing a vast improvement over the NASDAQ system. And when I say vast improvement, you have to understand the NASDAQ at that time, and it even went up through 1987 when it still had some problems. But a market maker could only look at one stock at a time, even though he was trading 20 stocks. So he would look at that stock and he would see what other people were doing, and then he would change his market depending upon whether he was a buyer or seller. Now, if he changed his market, then he could go to his next stop, and you can just understand that that would maybe take 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Fast-moving stock, he might be kind of behind the time in the ones that he hadn't gotten to. So we said, hey, we know that market makers make markets in 20-some-odd stocks, so we built a system that allowed them to look at all of the stocks at the same time, and we allowed them to change all of them a quarter of a point or a half a point or whatever it was with one click. So if the market was beginning to go down and the guy could see all of these stocks away from him going down, he could just say, quarter point down, click, he's down. So he's protected against being kind of sitting out there. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrific idea. And it was way ahead of itself. And
did it show limit orders?
Oh, well, yes, it would allow limit orders to be put in there. And our system, which we then introduced to the Cincinnati Exchange and said, okay, market makers can be in there. Brokers can come in and put limit orders in there. And the limit orders by the rules of the Cincinnati would take precedence, even though they came in after the market maker had put his bid in at 22.5. If it came in at 22.5, then it took priority. And so here we are as a market maker who, you know, had some special position. I mean, we had a lot of people who came into us first. We were saying in that market system, hey, we will give up any, let's say, advantages that we have in terms of a customer base that we have developed, obligation people might feel to us or whatnot. We will give that up to this concept that had been bubbling up and pushed by the New York Stock Exchange, incidentally, that the customer order that gets into the market ought to have priority. And so we said, okay, we'll build a system that does that. And it's called, and we'll call it a central limit order book. And it'll be on that system. And everybody can, the specialists on the New York, on the Midwest, First Boston, whoever wants to go into that system can make markets. But if E.F. Hutton comes in with a legitimate customer limit order, he can have priority. And that was the concept of our, I think we called it multiple trading, multiple market trading system. And we even got the three of the regional exchanges to experiment with it for a while. Until the New York Stock Exchange came along with their intermarket trading system and their promise to create a limit order system. I think it was called LOIS, Limit Order Information System, and there was another system that would allow people to have access, which never came about because the New York did, in fact, have the only limit order system in the marketplace. And they attracted business because having those limit orders allowed them to narrow their market and make it more attractive than anybody else.
Right.
Because it really allowed for the specialist to look like he was putting his money up in competition with other market makers, but he was really using limit orders in order to give that feeling, and that attracted quite naturally people to them. So the result of, so we designed this, we built it, we presented it to the Cincinnati. It was experimented with by other marketplaces, the Midwest, Philly, Boston, no, Pacific, and then when they were exposed to the intermarket trading system, they liked that better because that gave them something they hadn't had before, and that was this: New York said, okay, through the ITS, you can have access without it costing you anything as the market maker on the Midwest. Have access to the market on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
They go right to the specialists.
They could go right, and they didn't have to pay somebody who was a member of the New York Stock Exchange to handle that transaction.
Right.
So that was a goodie for them, and they were not ready to really go to have a marketplace that opened them to go toe to toe with the New York. They were hesitant. And of course we argued with them. We tried to present, look, it, this is your opportunity to become something besides something that gets crumbs. And of course, the result was that it wasn't until 2007 that finally the SEC got around to creating, forcing an electronic relationship among all the marketplaces. By that time, the various regional exchanges had gone off and were doing other things. They were options or derivatives or archipelago. They kind of disappeared. The Midwest did a little business, but the New York still did over 80% of the business prior to 2007. They got 90% of the revenue from the Composite Tape Association because their transactions became smaller than the transactions on the regionals. And finally, the National Market System, the regulation NMS, finally leveled the playing field. And the result was that the volume on the New York Stock Exchange went from over 80% to under 25%.
Right.
I mean, think about that when you wonder what the role of the SEC was during that period of time.
Yeah. It took a long time for a lot of people to adjust to the fact that that was going to happen. Mid-70s... Clearly, yeah. The New York Stock Exchange is still, people are still thinking about that as the model.
Right. You know, it's interesting that to the SEC's credit, they did use their authority to bring together all of the clearing and settlement and the depository, and that was great. There was a lot of, again, competition there. But it was... It was kind of like, the Federal Reserve, they brought everybody, state registered banks and nationally registered banks and all into the Federal Reserve system so you could clear through anybody, and it was a natural development to make the back office more efficient. And the SEC did that. They did the Composite Tape Association, leaving the New York under pressure from New York to have a veto power over any decrease in charges, but no veto power over any increase in charges. How did they do that? Why did they do that? This is an outsider taking a look at our regulatory body. And I would say that we were, I thought that the SEC under Casey finally did the right thing. I thought that under Brad Cook, his short time had made it clear that they were going to move forward to a central limit order book. The National Market Advisory Board, which was created by the Exchange Act amendments and appointees by Ray Garrett, were still responded to the mandate by the Securities Act amendments to create a national market system. Did in fact, make recommendations that that should have been reacted in terms of central limit order book by the SEC, but wasn't, because at that time there was a change in I think in 75, there was a change again in the direction of the SEC under Hill and then under Harold Williams.
Right. Was he the one who said he didn't want grass to grow on Wall Street or something like that? I don't want to let you go without talking about the National Market Advisory Board.
Okay.
Because that's a big landmark, and you were on that with a lot of other folks. And you talked about a mandate. Was it clear when you first convened that you had a mandate?
It was very clear that there was a national market, that the studies had indicated that we don't want the fragmentation. We think that fragmentation can be eliminated by creating an electronic system that incorporated all elements of the marketplace to centralize the reporting of transactions, centralize the display of what's in the market available, that would electronically allow everybody, every marketplace that wanted to play the game, to have equal access to what? To the centrality of the that had the concept that the customer was going to have the advantage, that there would be a central limit order book that allowed the customer, no matter who was making the market or where the other side came in, that they had a priority over the market makers. We'll get rid of this concept of having market makers be intermediaries on the floor of the any exchange or in the marketplace. What we want is, if there's an opportunity for a customer order to meet a customer order, that we want that to happen. Only way that that could happen efficiently is to have some sort of centralized system for showing limit orders on the behalf of customers, public, mm-hmm. and to have other public customers be able to interact with that directly without having the intervention from more. And that language was built into the mandate.
So one would think that a lot of the discussions then were about electronics and
absolutely.
How to design this electronic system.
And Bob Hall would testify on behalf of the New York Stock Exchange. It was going to cost, I don't know, $5 billion or something like that to build one of these things. And I mean, they were ridiculous statements of the complexity of it, the inability to for the technology to handle it, the cost would be, this was at a time that American Airlines system for integrating all of
Sabre.
The Sabre, right?
Yeah.
Here, Sabre has people all over the world seeing thousands of different airline schedules and being able to interact with one another in a very easy way, far more complex than what they were trying to build for the national market system. So it just it went on, and the problem is that 8 of the 15 people were, in a sense, members of the New York Stock Exchange. They might be on a regional, but they were still members of the New York Stock Exchange. And actually, the vote was a majority of the membership at the end voted for some sort of clause. The problem was that there was a hard club and a soft club, and some people said, well, just leave it up to the industry to figure out whether it should be a hard one or a soft one. And so it opened up the opportunity for the leadership of the SEC to finally, react to the New York Stock Exchange, who really didn't want a central limit order book. They wanted to keep their own central limit order book. And so they introduced the intermarket trading system, which in a sense, because it was in an inadequate electronic system to be able to do that. Bottom line. And that was, you know, that was our reaction to the SEC. It was that they just didn't understand the benefits. Now, they might say, well, we kept an industry going that was on hard times. It was too early to do this experiment. Blah, blah, blah. But to wait until early 2000 to get rid of 394 finally, and to wait till 2007 to finally do what they did in the back office area, which was very good back in the 70s, just seemed to me to, you know, suggest that the SEC did not understand really what its role was. And that was unfortunate. But, you know, I read this Historical Society description of the go-go years and the time. It doesn't speak to that. It really doesn't. It doesn't give the reader any sense of what was happening really, and what the SEC was missing in terms of their responsibilities. In terms of their responsibilities to really create a marketplace that would be the most efficient and the lowest cost.
Certainly after 75, when they were given that job.
No question. Yeah. And, you know, the idea that this account of these times starts with Truman Bidwell, a quote from Truman Bidwell saying that he really is America first and New York Stock Exchange second. What was the significance of that?
Yeah. Well, it's the New York Stock Exchange always had a special view of everything, I guess. That started with the New York Stock Exchange.
But the implications are someone has to say that.
Mm. Yeah.
That it's kind of like Nixon. I'm not a crook.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well. That's one of the reasons why it's important to get the other perspectives and look at, you know, not only the exchanges, but the other players in the market as well.
You know, I say all of this, and I have to say, for the record, that most of the people that I met at the SEC on the staff were intelligent, were sensitive to these issues in many ways. Tried to move things forward, and there certainly was a lot of discussion, I'm sure, and unfortunately uncertainty, therefore uncertainty breeds cautiousness in terms of, and I understand all of those. But the outcome was that it really took the SEC 30 years before they, and they still haven't done it. They still do not have a marketplace in listed securities that gives priority to the public order. Can you imagine that?
Well, let's wrap up a little bit with your company.
Right.
I'll take you back. After 75, you were in the middle of another kind of growth spurt, and you started to diversify, things like that. Did you see Did you have a problem with competition once the commission rates came off? Because, of course, your business had always been protected by the New York Stock Exchange's policies.
We had some, but we never felt that that was the problem that we had going forward. That the real problem that we had was that we had overexpanded. Our inventories to capital were higher than were appropriate in a time of growing inflation, particularly in the bond market. Not that we were acting casually or irresponsibly. We were getting into additional areas in our growth, most of which were in the bond area, mm-hmm. corporate bonds, government bonds, convertible debentures, unit trusts in municipals, all of those things. But our approach to taking on inventory and being primarily a market maker was slow in adjusting to a market that became more volatile. And we just, frankly, were not quick enough to react to that. And we had built up enough overhead that we were difficult to adjust to that quickly. And so we had to merge, which we did. And over 6 years, we were within the... Essentially, the merger continued the Whedon Holding Company structure. And when we left in 1985, the end of 85, we bought back essentially that structure, or that name of that structure, mm-hmm. and started over again, but concentrating only in our third market activity. That's what happened to us, and we had the economic model was quite different. We were more cautious. Our inventories were not as great, but we had a very good relationship with institutions that we had maintained while we were under the aegis of Moseley Hall Garden. And so we have, since 1986, we have continued to grow, and we do very well in that area.
So you're still working in the third market?
Yes, there were times when we actually joined the New York Stock Exchange, and then we found it was too expensive, that we could stop being a member and we could still execute transactions at a lower cost to us than if we were on the exchange. Mm. And so now we're, we are still part of what is, we really don't think of ourselves as a third market, because really the off-board activity in listed stocks dominates now.
Right. After 30-some years.
Right.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on that we should talk about?
No, a couple of things. I would say pretty much all of the staff, we had good relations. Some understood more than others what we were doing, and there was this unevenness in terms of the chairman. I think Phil Louvis stood out as probably being the smartest and best understanding of what was going on during that period of time. It's interesting, Rod Hills was a fraternity brother of mine at Stanford, and we mm-hmm. roomed together. And it's interesting that both of us, when he was chairman, we never talked about this issue, recognizing that we both had a responsibility not to make any attempt to influence or to even make use of my knowledge to find whatever he wanted to find out through other channels. I thought that was illustrative of what was a high point in, let's say, in the way in which chairmen and commissioners react to their responsibilities.
One other thing we haven't talked about is the people who worked with you in Wheaton. You've talked about we did this and we did that. Who were some of the most important people working with you on all through these years?
Well, the people that I relied upon in terms of this work were my two brothers and obviously my father. And that was where a great deal of the discussion and decision-making took place. Then there was a fellow named a good friend of mine, Fred Cecil, who had been working at the SEC and then went over to the American Stock Exchange. And I think it was around 1971 that we had the opportunity of hiring him. And he was very, very knowledgeable about these. They're very helpful in going down to the SEC and in our wanderings through the halls of Congress. I remember one time we went down and we're calling on Congressman Eckert. And we waited. We had a 45-minute meeting with him scheduled. And out of his office came about at least a half a dozen people led by Lee Kendall, who was the president of the Association of Stock Exchange Firms. They went off, and we all said hello. Then we went in for 45 minutes or an hour or whatever. It was really over the time that we were allotted. We came out, and there was Don Calvin with a whole phalanx of people representing the New York Stock Exchange. And it sort of illustrated what we were up against.
Yeah. caught between two really big players there.
Yes. And you know, I would say I met some very good people. I knew Don Stone, and we had a wonderful relationship. He was a good friend, is still a good friend, and we play golf. Don and my older brother and I fairly often now, but he was the representative of the New York Stock Exchange on the National Market Advisory Board, and I was the protagonist on the other side. And we would go at it for 2 days, you know, every month. But we agreed that we would go out and play tennis at the end of the first day, and then we'd have dinner, drinks, and dinner together. And so we did that. I played with Bob Swinnerton, who was from Dean Witter and Company. And he played with Rick Guerin, who was from, he was the New York Pacific Coast specialist. And we would go out and, you know, relax and realize that we're all professionals and we all have a point of view. And we're not going to cause it to interfere with our good friendship and our respect for one another. And that was another very important thing that I learned, is that despite all of our differences, those of us who were in the business trying to provide important services to various groups did have a respect for one another that overcame whatever competitive interactions that we might have.
Well, that's great. I appreciate hearing from you on all this. I think it's been a big contribution.
Great.
Thanks a lot.